I'm the director of the Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers here at the New York Public Library. I'll introduce tonight's terrific speakers in a moment. We're presenting this program in conjunction with Freedom Week. And I want to tell you a little bit about our upcoming programs, and then I'll come back to Patrick and Suketu. We have flyers by the door as you leave on purple paper, so grab one on your way out if you'd like to know more about what I'm telling you about right now. Next Wednesday, on the 30th of September, the Center's Deputy Director, Betsy Bradley, will be talking with the eminent writer and former Cullman Center Fellow, Philip Lopate, about Betsy's superb new book, Knickerbocker, The Myth Behind New York. And the moderator for that conversation will be the library's Andrew W. Mellon, Director of the New York Public Libraries, David Ferriero, who is now Obama's nominee to become the National Archivist. So three extremely wonderful people on that panel. And while I'm mentioning Betsy, I want to thank her for organizing all the programs that I'm telling you about right now, including the one you're about to hear. On Thursday, the 15th of October, the poet and former Cullman Center Fellow, Laurie Sheck, we'll read from her extraordinary novel, A Monster's Notes, which is written from the point of view of Frankenstein's monster. She'll show a short film as part of the evening, and we will have special one-night-only exhibition of items from the library's Forsheimer collection of Shelley and his circle on display just for that occasion. Then on November 5th, the center will celebrate the 10th anniversary of the New York Review of Books Classics, that fabulous series of handsome paperbacks that gives new life to famous and obscure literary treasures. Former Cullman Center Fellow Wendy Lesser will moderate a panel of writers who will talk about the books and what pleasures and surprises, good and bad, they find in them. The panelists will include Greil Marcus, Daryl Pinkney, Esther Allen, a translator and current Cullman Center Fellow, and others to be announced. Tonight, it's a special pleasure to welcome an old friend, a young old friend, back to the library and the Cullman Center calendar. Patrick Keefe, who was a fellow here several years ago, has just published a completely gripping account of the vast global underworld network of human smuggling run out of a tiny shop in New York's Chinatown by an unlikely criminal mastermind, a short, square-set grandmother called Sister Ping, the snakehead of the book's title. The story starts with the famous Golden Venture, a ship packed with 300 illegal immigrants from China that ran aground off the Rockaways in 1993, and it takes off into wide, utterly fascinating realms. I have to confess that I only started reading the book about a week ago, and it's been nearly impossible to get anything else done in any of my free time. Patrick is also the author of Chatter, Dispatches from the Global World of, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping, right?
That's right.
He writes for The New Yorker, Slate, and other publications, and he's a fellow at the Century Foundation. Here to talk with Patrick tonight is the distinguished fiction writer and journalist, Suketu Mehta, who's the author of the brilliant nonfiction book Maximum City, Bombay Lost and Found. He teaches at NYU's Journalism School. He's won a great many prizes, including a Whiting Writers Award and the O. Henry Prize. His journalism has appeared in the New York Times, National Geographic, Granta, Harper's, and Time, among other publications. Both of the writers have generously agreed to sign their books at a table by the exit as you leave, so after they're finished, please let them get out there instead of thronging up here to ask them questions so that they can start signing books. Finally, our thanks to the library shop for helping us with the book sales tonight. Over to you. Sorry, one more thing. There will be time for questions after they talk, and so Suketu will probably tell you when that time comes.
Well, thank you all for coming. I first became aware that there was another world in our midst. There was a third world in the middle of the first world, when I walked into a tenement in Chinatown last year. I walked up five flights with a housing activist who was refurbishing the tenement for low-income housing. And he showed me one of the apartments, which consisted of two small rooms and a kitchen, a total of about 500 feet. 15 people used to live there. There was a double bed in one of the rooms where a couple slept, and their children slept underneath the bed. There was another room where a few more people slept in shifts. So they rented not the apartment, not a room in the apartment, not a bed in the room in the apartment, but an 8-hour shift on the bed in the room in the apartment. In the kitchen, there were mattresses that had been spread out in the space between a bathtub and the stub. So the activists pointed out that the room had the advantage where you could actually soak in the tub and make your breakfast at the same time on the stub. Then he pointed out the box. Above the bathtub, attached to the ceiling, was a windowless box with slats for ventilation. And two adult human beings slept in the box. This was the world of Fujianese immigrants in the richest city in America. This activist told me that he knows how many people live in any Chinatown apartment by the number of shoes on the doormat outside. Under the shadow of these expensive condos in the Lower East Side and Chinatown are the ghettos of the Chinese immigrants. The first and the third worlds are not spread out around the globe. They coexist, a short subway ride from where we are. Human smuggling is second only to the global drug trade as a criminal enterprise. It's worth some $20 billion a year, as Patrick points out. Migration is a fact of our age. We are a restless species. 200 million of us now live in a country other than the one we were born in. And over half of migrants in the developed countries are women. For most of human history, we've moved across the globe free. It's only been about a century that to immigrate, to cross borders, has been considered a crime. In the United States, we've now created a new class of criminals, 12 million people who've come here without proper documents, the largest instantly created group of criminals in human history. A Colombian journalist in Jackson Heights told me he's noticed something about the immigrants, both legal and not, that he meets in the course of his work. They feel like they are less, he said. They're apologetic about their existence. And a young Congolese woman said to me, when you're an illegal immigrant, you are not you. Most of the time, you're someone else. For a long time, I've been searching for a book that would explain what was going on in the Chinatown tenement. This year, I found such a book that explained to me not only the world of Chinese immigrants, but also gave me invaluable insight into all the varieties of fearful, desperate migration around the world. And this is that book. It has as a central event the beaching of a ship called the Golden Venture in 1993 that ran aground off the Rockaways with 300 illegal immigrants in it, 10 of whom died in the landing. And what Patrick Keefe has done is to use that coming to America, this new Mayflower, as a point of departure for an absolutely riveting exploration of the world of the snakeheads, of the human smugglers who bring people, in this case, from the Fujian province of China to the United States. And I'd come across Patrick's article in The New Yorker last year, and I assigned it to my students at NYU. And then I read the full book as soon as it was sent to me by the New York Public Library. And it didn't take me very long at all. The wonderful thing about The Snakehead is that it's both literary and reportage, that it conveys a great deal of information about the policies of immigration, about Fujianese culture, about criminal underworlds, and it does so in beautiful language that along with the information, what the reader gets is pleasure in the text. And I know that this is something that very, very few nonfiction books achieve. So I guess the first question I'd like to ask you is, You've done an amazing amount of research. I mean, it's, the reporting is really staggering. 4 years that you spent on this book, 300 interviews with FBI agents, police officers, immigration investigators, attorneys, White House officials, the passengers on the Golden Venture, Chinatown residents, community leaders, and people in the snakehead business. Thousands of pages of court transcripts, government documents obtained through Freedom of Information Act requests and wiretap transcripts. Trips to Hong Kong, Fujian, and all around the United States. And you didn't speak Chinese. So how did you put it off? How did you actually do the reporting?
You'd think I would have picked up some Chinese by now, right? Well, thank you. Thank you for that introduction. And I should also say thank you to Jean and to Betsy and to the library for having us. And thank you, Sukeju, for being here. I've admired your work for years, and it's an honor to share a stage with you. I should also say, because it hasn't come up, though it will, that Sukeju is working on a book now, which I'm hoping he'll talk to us about immigrant communities in New York City. So there are a number of convergences here. I don't speak Chinese. I don't speak Mandarin or Cantonese, nor do I speak the dialect spoken by most of the Fujianese here in New York City, which is, I mean, you would call it Fujianese, but it's even more specific than that. It's the northern Fujianese or sub-dialect spoken in a handful of small communities around the city of Fuzhou. And this is one of the sort of funny paradoxes of this story, that in the last three decades, the vast majority of people who've come from China to the US, from this vast country, come from this one tiny area. It would be as if you went to, China and all the Americans you met were from Providence, Rhode Island, you know. So that was an issue, and I had to find interpreters from the beginning who could help me in my interviews and could actually sort of show me a little bit of the lay of the land. And in terms of the reporting itself, I mean, the reporting in Chinatown was challenging from the start, in part because I thought that I'm such an obvious outsider. I mean, it's written on my face. I don't speak Chinese, I began to think of it as the problem of the white guy with a notebook knocking on your door, you know, is generally not a good thing. But what happened was that I slowly started making some alliances within the neighborhood and meeting people who opened up to me. And actually, in a weird way, having the New Yorker article was extremely helpful, because I reported out the piece and wrote a long-ish article that came out, I guess, in the spring of 2006. And then I could give that to people. And I would say, I'm working on this book, but here's this article, and you can take a look at it and sort of get a sense of it. And there were a whole series of people I was trying to approach who didn't speak English, so that did me no good. They'd never heard of The New Yorker, and I would sort of confidently hand them the article, and they would sort of look at me, and they were often very crestfallen to learn that it wasn't New York Magazine that I had done it for. But there were a few people who read it and sort of saw what I was trying to do and then kind of blessed the project. And I think probably this is the sort of thing you encounter in a variety of cultures, but is maybe particularly true in Chinatown, that so much of the reporting was through relationships. And so what happened was that, you know, if I wanted to talk to you, I wouldn't approach you directly. I would approach somebody who was sort of at a 2-degree remove from you. And if that person kind of saw what I was trying to do and said it's all right, they would introduce me to someone who knew you, and that person would then eventually make the introduction to you. And in fact, when I went to China and Hong Kong and Thailand to do my research in Asia, I drew on those same relationships, people making phone calls in advance and saying, look, there's going to be this guy coming to talk to you. He's all right. So it was, I mean, it was a very slow process. But certainly an educational one.
And the person at the center of the story, Sister Ping, you had a series of written questions and answers in exchange with her, because the warden at Danbury prison, where she is now, wouldn't allow a face-to-face meeting because such a visit might jeopardize the security situation at the facility.
Right.
So yeah. Maybe you try to smuggle her out.
Exactly.
So what was that like? How did you get access to her and get her to talk to you?
Right. I mean, I should say just briefly, for those of you who are not familiar with the story, Sister Ping was a snakehead, the snakehead of the title, a Fujianese human smuggler who came to the United States in the early 1980s and began transporting people illegally from her home province here and charging them a hefty fee to do so. In the 80s, it was about $18,000, and by the 90s, it was $35,000. And she was active for many, many years, and the FBI estimates she made about $40 million doing this. Nobody knows how many people she brought over. But she's a famous figure in the Fujianese part of Chinatown here and also very much in Fujian province. She was eventually captured and tried in 2005, and she's now in federal prison out in Danbury, Connecticut, probably for the rest of her life. And my approach to her was kind of a sort of tentative and slow. I kept trying to go, at first what I did was, her family has a restaurant on East Broadway, 47 East Broadway, which I would encourage you to go to. It's a good Fujianese restaurant, and her husband and daughter still work there. And at first, when I was reporting the article, I would go in with my interpreter. I mean, it's kind of laughable in retrospect, and sort of in my notebook, and say, like, "I'm writing an article about Sister Ping. You know, can you talk with me?" And that didn't go anywhere. And over the years, what happened is, again, through these intermediaries, there were people that I met who knew her lawyer, her appellate lawyer. So her lawyer at trial didn't want anything to do with me. But when she was doing her appeal, her lawyer was actually fairly receptive. And he's a guy who has a lot of, he's a criminal defense attorney who has an office in Chinatown. And so I started going and seeing him. And then I got to know a woman who was her interpreter. And she's been in the court system for so long that there's this one woman who's her interpreter for kind of all of her dealings. And I got to know that woman. I talked with her a little. And eventually I persuaded them all that it would be in Sister Ping's interest to talk with me. And she agreed. And this never happens. I mean, I should say, like, I read about criminals with some regularity, and it's highly unusual that the lawyer blesses an interview of this sort. So I was really excited, and I made my appeal to the prison at Danbury, but the prison at Danbury has a very flinty-eyed warden who wasn't having any of it and didn't want me to come in, and I drew on I was supposed to be a lawyer instead of a writer, and so I sort of threw the book at her, and I kind of got back to her and said, "Well, I consulted the Code of Federal Regulation, and it turns out there's a presumption in favor of people being able to go into, you know, journalists being able to go into prison and interview people, and you need one of 9 enumerated reasons if you're not going to let me go in, and you need to give it to me in writing within 24 hours. And these reasons were all incredibly precise. It was all stuff like I had been caught smuggling a file into a prison in the past and stuff like that. Except there was one catch-all, which is that it would jeopardize the security situation in the prison. So 24 hours later, I got a fax in writing saying, number 9, it would jeopardize the security situation. Just to give you a sense of context here, FCI Danbury is the former home to Martha Stewart. This is Camp Cupcake. This is a minimum security women's prison in the suburbs of Connecticut. So the notion that a riot would have broken out seems a little untenable. So what we did was we then kind of agreed that I would put together a series of questions, and they would go into the prison and be translated by her translator. And then she would do her answers in Chinese, and they'd be translated again and come back out to me. And it's funny, I mean, this worked in interesting ways. The downside was that I didn't get to sit face-to-face with her, which after, at that point, 3 years of researching her life and career would have been great. Interestingly, the upside is that my questions to her were being translated to her by a woman that she knew really well and trusted a great deal. And so Lilia, this woman who was the interpreter, in some ways, I think, made her more receptive to my questions than they would have been had we been sitting face to face. Because what happened was this sort of very trusted confidant was coming in and saying, "So when did you start doing this? When did you come to the United States? Tell me about the time you spent in Hong Kong." And I think she was a little more forthcoming maybe because of that. I mean, not completely forthcoming. There are all kinds of areas that she wouldn't touch upon.
You said you write a lot about criminals. So do I. What is the attraction? I assume you were brought up in a normal middle-class household, not surrounded by criminals. So what draws you to investigating these secret worlds?
I think it's this, I think you hit on it. It's the secret aspect of it. I mean, the my first book was about wiretapping, and it would seem that there's no connection whatsoever between the two. But the connection, the sort of conceptual connection for me would be that there are these big forces at play in our society that we very dimly understand. And a lot of journalists just sort of figure that they're not going to go out and try and kind of do the shoe leather and figure out what's going on out there. And so for me, with wiretapping, it was that the NSA, the biggest intelligence agency in the country, had, which plays a huge role in the kind of day-to-day life of our country and in our foreign relations, was something that most writers didn't look at. And there were hundreds of books about the CIA and the FBI, but very few about the NSA. And it's similar with crime, I think. I'm interested in the way things move illicitly around the world and the sort of conjunction of that and illegal immigration, where you have this undocumented community of, we think, 12 million people. I mean, you said 12 million, but we know it could be 11, it could be 13. This is all back of the envelope math. We just don't know. And the sense in which there's kind of like an empirical point beyond which what you read in the newspaper doesn't go, that for me is very appealing as sort of the starting point. I mean, that's where I want to actually get in and start investigating. I mean, how about you? You must have had a similar, with Maximum City, there must have been similar issues at play.
Well, part of it was also the fascination of hanging out with the criminals themselves. I would interview these hitmen in hotel rooms and over days. And they would show me their weapons and occasionally point their weapons at me. So when I got out of those rooms, I mean, I have never felt so exhilarated. So that is a kind of adrenaline rush about going into dangerous situations and coming out alive. And also, I don't know if you found this, with people who live in the shadows, there's almost a fictional component to their lives. That is, they are regular fathers or brothers or whatever, and then it's other part of their life which is mythic or exaggerated. And they're not like actuaries or insurance agents. I don't know if you found this with...
Absolutely. I mean, this was part of what... So part of what fascinated me about the story to begin with was when I first started following it. Sister Ping was on trial in New York City in the summer of 2005. And the picture of her painted in the media was of a really malevolent kind of criminal kingpin. I still laugh about it. The tabloid, the Daily News and the New York Post just dined out on this trial for weeks. And, they would just have these kind of ridiculous, I mean, the headlines, of course, right? So it would be sort of, you'd have a big mugshot of her and it would say, snake, you know, a kind of 10 S's, like slithers into court, you know. And yet at the same time, in Chinatown, she was regarded as, I mean, I would say a more morally complicated person, but she really wasn't. She was regarded as a morally uncomplicated person, but on the other extreme. She was regarded as as somebody who had helped thousands of people achieve better lives in the United States. And there was a kind of a myth of Sister Ping, and it's something that I kept bumping into for years of research, is that both in Chinatown and also when I went to Fujian province, people would say she's Robin Hood, she's Harriet Tubman, you know, she kind of is this person who's actually conveyed people to much better circumstances. And the interesting thing about Sister Ping is that she, I think, very early on bought into that PR and started kind of churning it out in extraordinary ways. And so there's this whole mythology of her in Chinatown, which is that she was this humble shop owner who spent long hours in her shop, and she worked hard, and she may have made lots of money, but she wasn't ostentatious about it, and she was always looking to help people out. And that just kind of continued and got reified and repeated and exaggerated. And I think that she's actually, I mean, in her responses to me, there was a lot of that, of this notion of her as almost a martyr. And there's a funny story about her trial, which is that she, after she was convicted, the judge, who was Michael Mukasey, who went on after that case to become the attorney general and was, a fairly hard-nosed individual, gave her an opportunity to speak, as you often get, you know, sort of after the conviction, but before the sentencing. And generally in criminal trials, this will consist of somebody standing up and saying, sort of apologizing to the families of the victims or doing something to try and win, hopefully, a little bit of clemency. And he said, "Would you like to speak?" And Sister Brigham had been sitting there through weeks and weeks and weeks of trial not saying anything. And her lawyer stood up and he said, "I've advised her not to speak. I've advised my client not to say anything." And she said, no, I'm going to speak." And her interpreter stood up, and she proceeded to talk for an hour and to rehearse all of the events at trial and basically say, "You've got it all wrong. I was a martyr here." And actually, it was kind of crazy. She was bringing up things that she hadn't been indicted for, other crimes, and saying, "Oh, I didn't do that." I mean, there's an episode in the book where she takes out a hit on a journalist from the New York Daily News. And she was never charged for this. And during the sentencing hearing, I was sitting there just kind of thinking, what's going on? And she starts saying, "Oh, and that thing where they said, you know, I went after that journalist, well, it was more complicated than that, you know." But what she closed on was, she said, at that point she'd already been in prison. And she had this amazing speech. I quote it in the book, and I won't do justice to it here, but she said, "Oh, you know, in prison, if you want to send me to prison for the rest of my life, that's okay. I can learn to adapt in prison. You know, I take care of people in prison. There are people who come to prison and they're sort of lost and they don't have anybody they can count on, and I take care of them. I look out for them." And it was as if it was like her role in Chinatown, where she's dealing with all these Fujianese arrivals and sort of nurturing them, as if she's kind of transposed that to prison in her own mind. So I think that there was definitely a mythology there. And one thing I always sort of struggled with was, I didn't know to what extent she was just perpetuating this or kind of putting that story out there, and to what extent she'd actually come to believe it.
That's, I think, the most fascinating part of the book, the novelistic complexity of Sister Ping. After having done all this research, how did you actually put it together into a narrative? Because that's really, I think, where the book excels, where you get all this information which could really bore you senseless otherwise. And have, when I've read many of these policy papers. How did you decide on this kind of narrative? And why did you leave yourself out of it? Was that a conscious decision?
Wow. On the type of narrative, and I mean, I think particularly the issue for me, where I trained as a lawyer, I work at a think tank, and to some extent I wanted this to be a book about policy, but I also wanted it to... There was enough kind of narrative richness just in the story. And also, I mean, frankly, shootouts and car chases and, you know, people double-crossing each other and kind of, you know, and giving each other over to the FBI and wiretaps and all that stuff. There was enough of that that I sort of wanted that to be a Trojan horse in a way. And to be able to approach the larger issues of immigration and asylum and human smuggling and so forth through these characters and some of the drama. And in some respects, I think the story just kind of did that for me. It was there as I, you know, I'll give you an example. But the Golden Venture was this ship that ran aground in 1993. I'm sure some of you may remember it. And the reason it ran aground was that... they had been sending these smuggling ships from Asia to the United States, and they wouldn't come right into the shore. They'd stay out in international waters, and these gangsters, members of street gangs, would take fishing boats out to meet them in international waters and offload the ships and bring them back in. And the Golden Venture, it turned out, wasn't met out at sea, and it had been at sea for a long, long time. I mean, it's a crazy thing to think about, but the ship had been at sea for 120 days. And by comparison, the Mayflower was at sea in 1620 for 60 days. So they'd been in the hold of the ship for a long time, and nobody was coming to meet the ship. Well, it turns out the reason nobody came to meet the ship is that these young gangsters from this Chinatown gang were holed up in a safe house in Teaneck, New Jersey. Which is, if any of you know Teaneck, is not an environment where you would anticipate a safe house full of Chinese gangsters. And... A rival faction in the gang figured there are 300 people on the ship. They're each paying roughly $30,000. That's a $9 million bounty. If we can knock out these guys who are supposed to meet the ship, then we can go get it and collect that money. And so they rolled up and massacred the guys in the house. And it was this huge, unbelievably gory shootout. But these were young, slightly boneheaded gangsters. And they did this at about 6 p.m., on a May evening in Teaneck. And people were mowing their lawns, and kids were riding their bikes, and suddenly this Dodge Caravan full of black-clad Chinese gangsters pulls up. There's a huge amount of gunfire, and then they all run out, covered in blood, get in the Dodge Caravan, and it peels off. And within about 2 minutes, there had been a dozen calls to 911. And then, again, because these you couldn't make these characters up, they decided that the best course of action, these gangsters, was to take the GW Bridge back to Manhattan. And so I actually talked to the cop, but there's this Teaneck cop who gets the APB, and he's just sitting there, like hanging out at the entrance to the GW Bridge, and he says, "God, this Dodge Caravan's coming up. It sort of fits the description, you know." And he pulls them over, and the guys get out, and they're all covered in blood. But so the people who were supposed to meet the Golden Venture didn't meet it because they were dead. And these would-be usurpers couldn't meet it because they were all in jail. And that's the reason that the ship ended up running aground. So, I mean, a lot of it, there were these kind of actual sort of crazy narrative reasons why things happened the way they did. And it was just sort of there. On the second question, and I think this was one I wrestled with a lot, about not using the first person and not being in it. I mean, it's interesting you should say this, because in Maximum City, you so effectively had yourself there doing the reporting. And in some ways, you know, when you leave the hotel room, the reader is sighing with relief as well. And to some extent, I think that they're... Pardon me?
Most of them.
Well, I suppose, yeah. And my first book, Chatter, was much more kind of... self-conscious, and there was a lot of the first person singular. But I think that there were kind of narrative elements here such that I wanted to get out of the way and just lay it out there and have a sort of third person omniscient historical voice, which worked pretty well. What I did then was I sort of dropped the mask, and there's an epilogue where I say, and here's what I think, if only because these issues are so nuanced, and I do have fairly strong views about, I mean, for instance, like a moral evaluation of Sister Ping. In some respects, I think it would have been a cheat for the reader if I didn't at any point say, all right, this is all very complicated. My hope is that wherever you came, you know, wherever you sort of went into the book and wherever you came out, you sort of went through several reversals through the course of the narrative and your loyalties and where you are. But I felt I sort of owed it to the reader after 300 some odd pages to tell them where I was.
Yeah, Adrienne Nicola Blanc, for instance, in Random Family also keeps herself out of the narrative. But some like Roberto Fabiano, who's written an amazing book about the Neapolitan
Gomorrah,
mafia, Gomorrah, he's very much in it. That's his life story. You know, then there's Luis Alberto Urrea's The Devil's Highway, about the coyotes. So it seems to me that since the 90s, there's a very interesting category of books, I wouldn't call it a genre, which deal with crime and, you know, criminal justice and so forth in a very interesting narrative way. I mean, it's not a thriller exactly, and there's lots of information, and it's not also not Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, which, you know, it's a much simpler, straighter story. Did any of these books serve as models for you when you were doing the writing?
Literally almost all of them did. I guess not Saviano, because I didn't read him until after finishing the book. And by the way, there's a film, Gomorrah, which some of you may have seen. It's just stunning. Definitely do see it if you haven't. I mean, Random Families was a big... influence in its, I mean, both in its sort of dissection of a small community in New York and kind of play and using the narrative of what happened to really kind of boldly drawn characters to evoke a whole series of larger issues. And The Devil's Highway, which is an amazing book about a group of people who cross into the United States from Mexico in the desert, and many of them die, and it's just a harrowing, really brilliant, very lyrical book, was also an influence in that, you know, I mean, you, to some extent with Sister Ping, but even more so, there's another character in the book, in my book, Sean Chen, Chung Sing Chow, who's a young guy who left Fujian province when he was 18 and made this incredible journey around the world to get here. And he left home without a passport and without any money. He just had a backpack with a change of clothes, and he went to Western China and snuck across the border into Burma, and then he trekked through the mountains of Burma for a month, and eventually through the Golden Triangle, and then got to Bangkok and was in a safe house in Bangkok for 6 months, and then ended up getting onto a ship, and the ship broke down in the Indian Ocean and sort of limped into Mombasa, Kenya. And so at 18, speaking only Chinese, Sean sort of washes up in Mombasa, Kenya, and was in Mombasa, Kenya for 6 months, and then eventually gets picked up by the Golden Venture and brought sort of down around the Cape of Good Hope, up, the ship runs aground, people die, and then he's thrown into jail, and he's in jail for 3.5 years here. There's an almost kind of 19th century adventure story quality to what he went through that I think in a way you have to tell that story in a sort of slightly literary register, or I did. The sort of affective power that it has on the reader is such that you don't want to be just kind of purely blunt and declarative. And so Urrea's book was a big influence in that respect.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely essential to have this affective power because it's an emotional issue. These are people who've left behind everything that they've known, everything that's sure, all kinds of safety, really to make a better life for their children. And they're considered criminals for this. So I think you bring that across really well. Your empathy for these immigrants is really apparent, and nowhere more so than the section you have about the passengers of the Golden Venture who were in prison and started making sculpture. And
yeah.
I'm wondering if you might read out a bit of it.
Sure, yeah.
Because it's so beautifully written, and I think it will give those of you who haven't yet read the book a flavor of the book. So this is in page 242, which has this wonderful flourish of an ending. So whatever section you...
Sure, yeah, yeah. I'll read the end, I'll just set it up a little bit so as not to read too much. The after this arduous journey, the passengers on the Golden Venture arrived in New York, and they were detained. It was sort of the birth, in a way, of modern immigration detention, which is a huge, wide-scale issue in the United States now, but this was the first time that we'd taken a really large number of people who arrived and were asking for asylum in the U.S. and locked them up. And many of them were farmed out to, it's funny because originally they were locked up in New York, and there are a lot of immigration lawyers in New York, so they immediately went down and started volunteering pro bono to bring their cases. And suddenly the INS realized, well, we'd better sort of get them out of here. So they sent them off to York, Pennsylvania, in central Pennsylvania, where there were no immigration lawyers and indeed no immigrants. There they remained for much of the next 4 years. And one of the things that happened, which was this kind of curious development, is that the community rallied around the detainees in York in all kinds of surprising ways. And this odd network of supporters and lawyers kind of started doing vigils at the prison and bringing their asylum cases. And inside, there was a guy that I ended up tracking down and interviewing named Yang Yu Yi, and he had been a weaver back in Fujian province. And one day he was bored and he started folding. He had a legal pad and he tore out a piece of legal paper and he started doing this sort of origami. And he had known about this kind of from China, but he was also sort of devising his own little, he's incredibly good with his hands, his own little techniques. And he made this beautiful paper, kind of corrugated pineapple. It was all made out of legal paper, and then it had these kind of, you know, used a magic marker, green kind of spreads. And people started saying, oh, what's that? How did you do that? And he started teaching people. And soon there were dozens of these Golden Venture detainees folding paper, and they would get kind of magazines and old newspapers that the guards left behind. And these sculptures started getting bigger and more ambitious. They ended up making thousands and thousands of sculptures. And I guess I'll just read you quickly a little bit about these sculptures. The art was a sensation. Soon the proprietor of a New York gallery specializing in American folk art got in touch and began selling the sculptures. The press started to take note. Life magazine, ran an article about the Golden Venture immigrants with a portfolio of photos of the sculptures. The art seemed emblematic of both the work ethic and the talent of the men who wanted nothing more than to leave prison and become productive members of the American workforce. It was a perfect calling card for those lobbying to set them free. "There's some intelligent people here," Bev Church, this is one of the supporters, told a reporter. "They're not just some peasants who fell off a rice paddy." The detainees at York ultimately produced 16,000 sculptures, and through Cindy Loback's sale, that's another of the supporters' sales, earned $135,000, which they used to defray the cost of their legal cases. Pieces ended up in the collections of Dan Rather, Peter Jennings, and other notable personalities who took an interest in the case. A traveling exhibit of the sculptures was featured in museums and galleries around the country, including the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. Several of the most talented sculptors were eventually released from prison and granted special visas for aliens of extraordinary ability in the arts. One of the most striking aspects of the artwork the men produced during their years in York County Prison, and surely one of the reasons for the attention and enthusiasm it garnered, was the preponderance in the designs they selected of Americana. The red, white, and blue of the American flag became a recurring color scheme. The men clipped Made in America stamps from Walmart ads and affixed them to their work. They loved birds, especially birds of prey, and American bald eagles in particular. After one of the men created a papier-mâché eagle alighting on a white branch and inscribed the words "Fly to Freedom" on the branch in English and Chinese, the supporters in York began calling the sculptures freedom birds. There were birds in mid-flight, their fearsome talons clutching the air in front of them, and birds standing sentry in repose. Many of the paper birds were captive, locked up in ornamental cages. The sculptures that the men produced behind bars and sent to the outside world would serve as a form of prison letter, less articulate than those of Gramsci or Martin Luther King, perhaps, but no less eloquent. There was a kind of rough-hewn poetry to a sculpture of the Statue of Liberty that was made entirely of toilet paper and had taken a detainee 3 days to construct. To some extent, all of this was surely calculated, designed to play on the sentimentality of Americans on the outside who might be in a position to help. But at the same time, the sculptures provided a kind of testimony, suggesting for the men at the York County Prison, for whom the reality of the United States had proved to be such an unmitigated nightmare, the idea of America, that beautiful idea that had launched the Mayflower and the Golden Venture and 10,000 other ships, remained miraculously unsullied.
We have some time for questions, if anyone would like to ask some questions. I think there's a mic somewhere.
The mic is right here, so please come up.
Hi there. My question is probably more for Mr. Mehta. Is there an Indian equivalent to Sister Pen? And I don't think there is. I've never heard of one. And so I guess the question would be, why not? You know, with a giant population and grinding poverty and entrepreneurial culture, why? What's unique about Chinese immigration that doesn't translate to Indian?
Well, I know for the Punjabi equivalent of the snakeheads, and I've met a number of Indians who've been smuggled across, but that smuggling is subcontracted out to Mexicans in Guatemala. So, you know, they'll pick them up from Punjab and then they'll have reciprocal agreements.
Outsourcing.
I know of, it operates in the same way, and when I was reading the snakehead and these descriptions of the Fujianese village where people had built these elaborate mansions with remittances. You can go to villages in Gujarat or in Punjab and see the same kind of villages. There's an area called Charotar in the, it's a district in Gujarat, where the villages only have the very old and the very young. Everyone of working age has gone abroad, usually illegally. And I mean, it's quite heartbreaking. I was speaking to a babysitter who told me that she'd been very distressed the other day because someone had showed her some pictures of a family wedding, and she pointed to one of the pictures and said, "Who's that?" And the person showing the picture said, "That's your daughter." She hadn't seen her for 10 years, and she'd grown up in this, in her absence, unrecognizable. And she said that every Sunday she would speak to her daughter. So I've seen this among West African immigrants, among Latino immigrants, among Indian immigrants. So there are people who do this thing, but to my knowledge, there isn't someone sitting in Jackson Heights who's an Indian equivalent of Sister Ping. I think they let other people do the rough stuff.
Yes, you mentioned about the immigrants who were kept in York. Did you have occasion to research anything about the men who are kept in county jails, such as in New Jersey, and for a couple of years?
I don't know which. Do you mean on immigration grounds? Because that, I mean, this is a
yes, immigration grounds.
Right. Yeah.
Well, they were held in Patterson and New Brunswick. Or
yes.
Whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is part of the legacy of the Golden Venture, is that when I go through it at some length in the book, but up until the Golden Venture arrived, what would happen if you came to this country illegally was usually, if you asked for asylum, you might be detained briefly, but then generally what would happen is they would say, look, we're going to set up an asylum hearing for you, but the system is so backed up that it could be a year, 14 months, and so they would give you working papers and let you go. And some people showed up for the asylum hearings and some people didn't. When the Golden Venture came, there had been people lobbying to change that policy because they thought that it was a magnet, that it was drawing people to leave and take these dangerous trips to get here. And so this was the first instance when they said lock them all up. In the years since, and particularly since 9/11, immigration detention has become the fastest growing form of incarceration in the U.S. And it's this broad, decentralized, underregulated system in which county jails in places like York, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey actually regard this as a way of, as a profit stream, basically, that they get contracts with the federal government to take people in. They supply a certain number of beds. The problem is that there's very little oversight. And some of you may have been following this, but the New York Times has done some great coverage of the way in which people can just get lost inside this system because there's no real sort of central register. Nina Bernstein has done amazing stuff literally even the federal government has no accurate tally of how many people have died in immigration detention. They couldn't tell you with any certainty what the numbers are. This is troubling. The Obama administration has said they're going to address it, but it all actually goes back to the Golden Venture. And York County Prison, which started out, this was the first time that they took immigrants, it has since become one of the biggest immigration detention facilities in the country.
Well, I wanted to add something to my response to your question about the Indian snakehead. There is actually a form of Indian smuggling, which I don't know if it's unique to Indians, but you know these Bollywood song and dance troupes that come over with hundreds of dancers and comedians and singers? Well, more of them come into the country than go back. So there was actually a Bhangra star, a Bhangra is kind of Punjabi music, named Daler Mehndi, who was very popular in India. He's a Sikh man who was arrested for basically selling places in his troupe. They would all be given visas to come over and entertain American audiences. And he would make a lot of money by giving places in his troupe to people who just wanted to stay here. So they would get here and, you know, they would sing and dance their way off the stage and into the country.
And into our hearts.
Curious, and I'm looking forward to reading the book. I don't know that much of the history. I'm curious about gender. You know, the criminal kingpin in popular literature is not usually a woman. and I don't think of China as a matriarchal country, although I know there's some nuance there. So I'm curious if that is something you deal with.
I mean, I think that this is part of what made, initially what made Sister Ping quite famous in the Chinatown community, is that she bucked the trend in more or less every respect. The traditional pattern with the Fujianese was generally that the husband would go over first and sort of get a toehold and then send for the family. The opposite happened with Sister Ping. Some of this, again, it all comes down to the personalities. Some of this is that Sister Ping married an especially hapless individual, the sort of sweet, pathetic Cheng Yuk Tak, who is a slightly comic character in the book. But she's sort of the fire and the brains behind the operation, and Cheng Yuk Tak was always a little bit of a second fiddle. So in fact, he had come to the United States first, but he got deported almost immediately. It didn't work out, and he went back, and then she had to actually go and kind of set up the beachhead. The funny story with him is that his chief role in the operation seems to have been taking the large sums of money that the family was making and transporting them out of the country to China. And so if you look at his rap sheet, it's hilarious because it's like, it's like 1986, apprehended at the airport in, Trenton with $78,000 in cash in a suitcase. Like 1989, apprehended at the airport in, wherever. It may just be out of necessity that she became such a dominant figure. Having said that, in the years since, there have been other female snakeheads who have risen to prominence. And in fact, in the UK, many of you, I'm sure, remember the terrible incident at Dover. One of the chief snakeheads behind that was a Fujianese woman known as Little Sister Ping, which was sort of an homage. And I mean, her name was actually Ping, but it was also, and also she was small, like very tiny. But it was also kind of an homage to Big Sister Ping. And there's another woman I read about in the book who's a Central American human smuggler, Gloria Canales, who's another big figure. So, I mean, it certainly happened. But you're quite right. The prevailing norm would be that the men would go first.
I have a question about the, sort of related to the passage you read about the idea of America versus the reality. And obviously a lot of people who are willing to risk their lives and, borrow huge sums of money are drawn probably by an idea that may or may not shake out in reality. And, even after this guy ends up in jail and gets freed, he ends up in Columbus, Ohio or something where he may or may not be living the dream. So what was your finding in terms of what drew people, and were they ever, disappointed, I threw my life away for nothing, or how does that, and also how does that play in with their Chinese identity and their Chinese nationalism?
Right. Boy, the last part of the question is so complicated that I may just punt. In terms of Chinese identity and Chinese nationalism, very briefly, in Fujian province there was this idea through the 80s and 90s, and to some extent this dates back to the 19th century and to the gold rushers coming in, and people still to this day refer to America as the Golden Mountain, and there's this notion, and particularly out in the countryside, there was this notion that you could kind of make it in America, and in a year you could make what it would take you 10 years to make back home. And that this was a great land of prosperity. One of the really strange things is that the message didn't always get back. So you'd get somebody who arrived here and they paid off their snakehead debt, and then they're living in a bed which they rent in shifts, and they're working 13 out of every 14 days and 12, 14 hours a day, and the boss often will withhold wages because they're undocumented and will sort of say, oh no, I'll pay you next week. And it puts them in this dilemma where they don't know whether they should stick around and keep providing more free labor because they will get paid, or whether they should take off because the boss isn't going to pay. They'd be in these terrible situations where they get injured on the job and they have nowhere to go. And they're not going to get any kind of compensation. These things happen all the time. And then they'd call home and they'd say, it's great. I'm glad that I made this decision to leave. And I think in some ways that perpetuated this myth beyond the reality. In terms of the issue of sort of Chinese culture and identity, I mean, I think that it gets really complicated, and I get into this a little bit in the book, but one of the weirdest things is that many of these Fujianese came and asked for asylum, and they would say, I'm fleeing the one-child policy. People tried to sterilize me or force me to have an abortion. I wanted to have a big family. Or I'm a democracy protester. Or increasingly these days they'll say I'm Falun Gong. But if you actually talk to Fujianese people, even people who say these things, as distinct from, say, Taiwanese or Cantonese in America, they're fiercely nationalistic. Like they actually love China, and they remit huge amounts of money back to China. So it's a really tricky issue.
Hello. So I have a question in regards to your comment about your county prisons being, I guess, one of the largest immigration detention centers. And actually, that pretty much blew me away because I'm from there, unfortunately. So I just wanted to know, you kind of got into it a little bit as far as how some of these counties or prisons are picked, but do you know anything more specifically as to how your county got picked for these particular immigrants?
Well, I'll tell you the conspiracy theory, which is that it was a long way from any immigration attorneys. I mean, the conspiracy theory basically is that when the Golden Metric came in, it was extremely embarrassing for the Clinton administration. Again, many of you must remember this, but it was on the front page of the newspaper because within an hour or two of the ship coming in, you had press circling. And the idea was we need to get these people in and out as fast as possible. And so what they didn't want was lots of lawyers coming in and representing the people. And so at the time, there were all these lawyers in York who've since become like immigration lawyers. But in 1993, they described, and I read about them in the book, but they, you know, they described themselves as like, oh, I'm a country lawyer, you know, I write wills for a living, which was a little self-deprecating. I mean, that was not actually entirely the truth. But what happened is that people were farmed out to York, I think just because there was space there and it made sense for York. And I have to say, I mean, it's been a huge revenue stream for York County. I mean, it's really good this is the way it works, though. And it's funny, a lot of these new facilities, there are these big mega facilities, immigration facilities, they're being built. And they'll be built in really impoverished communities in West Texas, where there's nothing else going on. And it's really hard to find people in the community who will say, no, don't create this prison here, which is going to have, you know, several hundred jobs. And so forth. So I don't know, strictly speaking, why York was chosen, but I think the fact that it was in central Pennsylvania probably had something to do with it.
How you doing? Sorry, I lost my voice today, but I was wondering politically how you personally evolved during the course of writing this book. As far, I mean, from the epilogue, I sort of gathered what some of your feelings were on the subject of phony asylum claims versus non-phony asylum claims and so on and so forth. But I was just wondering if, when you went into this, if you already had a certain political view on immigration, whether legal or illegal, and how that might have evolved over the course of your research and when you finished the book. And then my other question, which is not as deep, was just I was wondering if there was a movie or a documentary in the works about this and what your next book, if you're working on your next book, and what that is.
Okay, I'll take the easy ones first. Movie or documentary, I'm talking with various people about various things, one never knows. I think that on my last book I rushed into an option rather foolishly, and I'm not going to do that this time, so I think if there is something, it will hopefully not be embarrassing or a non-starter. In terms of my next book, no idea. I'm just going to kind of keep doing magazine articles, I think, for now and sort of see where that goes. But it won't be about Chinatown or human smuggling, I can tell you that. On how I evolved, I mean, I definitely ended up, you know, in a similar place to where I'd started in terms of my sympathies, which is to say I'm pretty pro-immigrant and pretty anti-snakehead. And I think that there is a nuanced way of looking at the world where you can kind of see those things together and sort of they don't conflict too much. The one thing that I came away with really strongly as a conviction after having concluded my research is that any discussion of kind of turning off the faucet on illegal immigration. So, I mean, Chuck Schumer now has taken up the mantle from Kennedy and saying, we're going to put the 12 million illegal immigrants on a path to citizenship, but we're also going to get tough. And so we're just going to stop further illegal immigration into the country, so we'll kind of keep it at 12 million. I just think it's naive. I think that there's no way that they're so sophisticated, these networks, and there's always going to be a market, and where there's a market, there are going to be really clever entrepreneurs like Sister Ping. I think that the one thing you could do if you really wanted to, not necessarily put a stop to illegal immigration, but really take down the numbers from where they are now, is, and this would take some tinkering, is say that the children of illegal immigrants born in the United States are not U.S. citizens. Because again and again and again, I found that that was that's the American dream, is the idea that I will take any risk, I will risk my life, I will go into debt, I know when I get there it won't be a party, I'll be working like crazy, I will live a miserable life, but I'll have a child that's born on U.S. soil, and that child will be a U.S. citizen, and will go to school here, and it's like, it's this generational sort of project. And I think that's the siren song of America. I think it's part of what makes this country great and vibrant. I think if you're really serious about stopping people from coming, then that's what you need to withhold. I wouldn't want us to do that, and I think it would be a little difficult constitutionally. But I think that's why people are coming. I mean, I don't know, you probably have a sense of this as well, but that was one sense that I got again and again. I mean, to go to the earlier question, these people take all these risks and they get here and they live these horrible lives. So what's in it for them? What's in it for them is they know that their kids might grow up and go to American colleges.
Well, is illegal immigration bad for America? Have you reached any conclusion for that? Is it a good thing or bad? Economically, does it really hurt people? Because this is where you get into all these debates. As, you know, George Borjas says one thing, other economists would say something else.
Well, from what I understand, I mean, Borjas basically comes out saying that it's bad for African Americans without much education, that it hits them, and that every other sector of society ultimately actually does sort of benefits from it. I think that, look, I mean, I think the rule of law is a good thing, and I think that we should not have a system in which there are pervasive violations of law. And some, I mean, the INS and ICE, in all my time researching these federal institutions, do not inspire confidence. And I don't think that that's a good thing. But certainly, what I found, and I'm sure you found the same, is that these jobs that people are doing, they're not jobs that anyone, even high school dropouts, want to do in many instances. And I think as long as that demand is there, I mean, look, you see this in the Southwest. You go to Arizona, these areas where, right close to the border, where people are very fiercely anti-immigrant in many instances. And you go to a Home Depot, and you're going to see a whole bunch of people, you know, driving through in their pickups, getting ready to pick up day laborers to come and do work at their house that they don't want to pay somebody else to do. As long as they're, the Ecuadorian guys, the Salvadorian guys, they wouldn't go and stand outside the Home Depot if there wasn't a good chance somebody was going to come and pick them up. So.
Well, I found this with the head of the New York Minutemen that I interviewed for my book.
There is a New York Minutemen?
There's not a lot of them, and they're very unhappy. And I remember speaking to this man, and we met in a Starbucks, and the first thing he said was, "I'm not a racist." I said, "I never said you were." But he began with this very defensive position, and then, you know, told me about the rise, and there's all these people coming, and they're going to dilute the Judeo-Christian ethic of the country and so forth. And then I said, "What do you do?" And he gave me his business card. It said, "R. Stewart Cutlip," with a kind of Scottish crest on it. "So what do you do?" He said, "I'm a golf course landscape designer." Said, "Well, golf course, who works and builds these?" He said, "I know what you're getting at. All right. More than half of my workers are illegal, all right?" So you could see where here is a man living a contradiction every day of his life.
If you'll just permit me a quick follow-up, the USCIS, I personally, I think I had a more lucky story. My wife is Canadian, and we went through the green card process. We got married, not for the green card. I'd like to think she married me for love, but I found my experience very pleasurable, but I think that had a lot to do with the fact that It was the northern border of the United States. It was a white upper middle class Jewish woman marrying a white upper middle class Jewish man. And it, to be quite frank, it was that was. And I was wondering something that the book didn't totally touch on. And I was hoping you could enlighten us. Was how has the illegal immigrants from China affected the USCIS or INS or whatever the acronym is, their attitude towards legal immigration and how they, and like when Chinese people actually apply for straight up green cards, how the numbers are affected as far as how they deal with, you know, what their policies are, if you know anything about that.
I think you may have stumped me. I mean, the one thing I'll say in terms of the Chinese and specifically the Fujianese is that it has, the huge amount of illegal Fujianese immigration has, I think, given the immigration authorities a really jaundiced eye toward applications, particularly from Fujian province. Look, I think if you were a computer scientist in Beijing with a postgrad degree and a lucrative job set up for you here, you're probably not going to have too much trouble. But if you're Fujianese or from anywhere in that part of the world and you don't have much education, good luck with the green card.
Are there illegal American immigrants in China?
I wonder. I mean, I'll tell you a funny story about, I mean, part of what I was dealing with in the book is that China's fortunes had changed so much since the 1980s, 1990s. And when I first went over, it was actually when I went to Thailand, I was talking to these kind of Thai immigration officials, and I said, "Oh, I'm writing a book about Chinese human smuggling," and they said, "Oh, people being smuggled into China? It's a huge problem, you know." So you never know.
Hi, real short question. Has all of this spread over to the other boroughs, like Flushing, the same type of, and Sunset Park? That same thing?
Yeah, I mean, and in fact, it's all connected because Chinatown, really in the kind of 80s, burst its borders. There's so many people coming in because there's been this huge wave of migration just in the last 30 years, and it's largely people coming from Fujian province, and that's part of what has created these pretty vibrant satellite Chinatowns. So now, I mean, I talk about Chinatown, and what I'm talking about really is Chinatown in Manhattan, but there are this is a house of many Chinatowns, or a Chinatown of many mansions. Yeah.
Okay, I think.
Thank you.